This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
But we begin with a major announcement by the federal government, a roadmap for rapidly evolving technology that's been finally unveiled after months of delay. Prime Minister Mark Carney released Canada's new national AI strategy. He says it will create thousands of AI-related jobs while protecting Canadians.
Our strategy has three guiding principles. The first is trust. We will protect your data, your privacy, and your children. Second, opportunity. We will empower Canadian workers, Canadian businesses, Canadian students with the tools to expand their knowledge, their expertise, and their futures. And finally, sovereignty. We will reinforce Canadian sovereignty so Canadians can make their own choices on how AI is built, governed, and used.
Welcome back to the Law Bites podcast. I had several potential guests lined up for this week's episode, but after what may have been the most eventful week in Canadian digital policy in years, I wanted to just take a few minutes to take a breath and bring everyone up to speed. Three major issues in the space of just a few days, and any one of them would have been worth an episode on their own. The government announced it's reversing the CRTC's Online Streaming Act ruling. I should note that they did that before I even had time to do an episode on the decision itself. It released its long-awaited national AI strategy, and it kept pushing for Bill C-22, the lawful access bill, which entered clause by clause at committee. Let me take the time to examine each on its own. First, the streaming decision. As I mentioned, I didn't have the chance to address it in an earlier episode, but in late May, the CRTC released its decision on the required contributions and discoverability requirements arising from the Online Streaming Act. Let me quote my first paragraph from my initial post on the decision. I stated, "Given the likely opposition from many stakeholders, it is virtually certain to lead to protracted trade and legal battles. From the moment the government introduced Bill C-10 in 2020, its goal was to impose regulatory obligations on internet streaming services, treating them as online broadcasters and mandating that they pay into the Canadian system. This week's ruling puts a number on the payments, building on an earlier 5% interim levy with an additional 10% in expenditure requirements. The combined 15% places Canada among the most expensive operating jurisdictions in the world for streaming services, with consequences that will undoubtedly affect consumer streaming prices. Moreover, with the streaming services already challenging the interim 5% levy in court, they will undoubtedly challenge this one as well. In fact, the battle will not be limited to Canadian litigation. The U.S. government, which has become increasingly vocal in its opposition to the Online Streaming Act, will view this decision as a provocation and escalate pressure on Canada to drop the legislation altogether." Culture Minister Mark Miller appeared to hedge in his reaction to the decision, suggesting that the government sees the headaches that lie ahead. Well, less than 2 weeks later, the government killed the centerpiece of its own broadcasting policy, announcing plans to issue a new policy direction that will effectively override the CRTC's decision. The reversal, which undoubtedly reflects the harm caused as part of the trade negotiations with the U.S., will come at a cost to taxpayers, as the government also promised a $600 million payout to the audio and audiovisual sectors to cover the anticipated lost revenues. Now, governments do not move to unwind CRTC decisions within 2 weeks unless they've concluded that the decision just simply can't stand. And there's a procedural reason that it's being done this way. The Broadcasting Act contains no review and vary power over the contribution and expenditure decisions, and the governor in council's review authority reaches only licensing decisions. So the government simply can't vacate the ruling. It has to force the result through with a fresh policy direction of general application and what will be a new CRTC proceeding, with that $600 million payout to the sector serving as a bridge to keep the sector on side. Miller framed the move entirely in terms of affordability and consumer choice, cautioning that the Commission's requirements could be borne by Canadian consumers through higher prices. Now, that risk has been obvious since the government introduced the legislation years ago. In fact, it's close to word for word for the case that I made before the commission back in December 2023, namely that consumer interests, competition, and affordability belonged at the center of broadcast and internet policy. But we should notice what the release never mentions: CUSMA, trade, retaliation, or the United States. The problem was that the CRTC's approach raised obvious trade risks and opened the door to massive tariff retaliation if the government relied on the cultural exemption in the trade agreement to press ahead. It's worth unpacking for a moment the decision that will, soon enough, be effectively moot. As part of the decision, the commission not only set the amount, but also dictated how the money was to be spent. A minimum of 30% of qualifying Canadian programming expenditures flowing to enhanced partnerships, which were defined as productions in which a Canadian broadcaster or Canadian independent producer holds more than 50% of the copyright, with a Canadian independent producer in turn defined as a company in which the streamer holds less than 30% of the equity. Bottom line, the foreign streamer was required to spend the money, barred from owning the majority of what it funded, and blocked from controlling the producer that does. While the opposition characterized the CRTC outcome as a tax, it was actually a regulation dictating how foreign capital had to be deployed in Canada and who would own the result. That regulatory approach treads on dangerous ground because CUSMA's investment chapter contains a prohibition on performance requirements in Article 1410, a requirement that dictates how a company spends and counts that spending only if a domestic entity owns the resulting copyright is exactly the kind of thing that Article 1410 prohibits. Now, CUSMA allows Canada to keep cultural measures that would otherwise breach the agreement with its cultural exemption, but that is subject to Article 32.6 sub 4, which gives the U.S. the right to respond with retaliation of equivalent commercial effect applied to any sector it chooses. As I argued back in March, that means that the U.S. can impose tariffs on sensitive Canadian economic sectors, such as dairy, lumber, or steel. Since 15% of the large streamers' Canadian revenues ran into the hundreds of millions of dollars, $600 million by the government's account, any equivalent commercial effect retaliation would match that figure and be applied to Canadian goods unrelated to streaming. So it's no surprise that the beneficiaries of the money weren't concerned. The retaliatory tariffs wouldn't have hit them. Beyond the retaliation, the decision handed the U.S. a card to play at the very moment that our most important trade deal is up for review. And much like the rapid abandonment of the digital services tax, the government quickly signaled that it's prepared to drop the policy altogether. The $600 million is worth emphasizing because it's an explicit substitution, not a top-up. The government says the investments will ensure creators, producers, and broadcasters receive the financial support they otherwise would have had from the CRTC decisions. The original bill was sold on the promise of making web giants pay. I argued at the time that consumers would get the bill regardless of the framing, and now the government has established a system in which the public clearly pays. To be fair, the government insists the Online Streaming Act itself was and remains a necessary step. But the objectives now set out for the coming policy direction, affordability, consumer choice, flexibility, and leveraging public investment, were largely dismissed as priorities throughout the legislative and regulatory process. Better late than never, I suppose, but what's needed for the next round is a willingness to rethink the foundation of a cross-industry subsidy model that long ago stopped reflecting the realities of Canadian film and television production. The very next day, the government released its much-anticipated national AI strategy, an ambitious plan with a myriad of new programs and initiatives to support AI adoption. It emphasizes trust with the branding as AI for all. Spending dominates the decision, with money sprinkled across the economy as the government bets on the economic returns that flow from widespread adoption of AI. But spending money is the easy part. What stands out is the deferral of many of the hard policy choices. There are no plans for AI-specific regulation. The government is instead relying on updated privacy rules and a reintroduction of online safety or online harms legislation. Canadian government will never outspend the market on AI. Supporting AI development has to primarily involve creating the legal and regulatory frameworks that facilitate investment, trust, and adoption. Deferring the hard choices to later doesn't help. Now, I'll leave some of the spending promises to others and discuss the business realities of the AI strategy in next week's episode. My quick take on it, though, is that the strategic spending on health data initiatives is worthwhile. Government adoption programs have a poor track record, and replacing private sector investment is a waste of taxpayer money. The strategy is best when it makes genuine policy choices, and several of them are the right ones. It commits to advancing open source AI as a counterweight to dependence on a handful of proprietary systems. It supports creators not by locking down content with new licensing mandates or restrictions on copyrights fair dealing, but by enabling them to use AI as they see fit, including through a new $50 million creative technology program. And it treats data as a strategic national asset to be mobilized. Scrapping an EU-style AI act is also justifiable, I think, given that the framework has failed to take hold worldwide and the EU has struggled with implementation. But the absence of clear transparency requirements is harder to understand. I've argued for an AI Transparency Act. Disclosure of where AI is used, of which works are included in training data, and of government and law enforcement demands for user information. The strategy reduces that to a promise to work on transparency over time, a reference to watermarking, and a voluntary Canada-trusted AI certification program. It says nothing about requiring companies to disclose which works they used to train their models, the very information that would let users and creators make informed choices. Instead, the strategy relies on privacy reform and online harms or safety legislation as the foundation for trust. I think those are necessary but not sufficient. On privacy, it promises a bill that would recognize privacy as a fundamental right, alongside stronger penalties and updated safeguards. But having lived through previous failed attempts at privacy reform, it's easy to be skeptical. There's also a bigger problem with that promise that I'll address in a moment. The sovereignty pillar acknowledges that sensitive Canadian data may fall under foreign legal regimes and says that Canadian infrastructure must be operated under Canadian control and Canadian law. But locating data in Canada does little if Canadian privacy law is weak or if a foreign court can still compel disclosure from a provider with operations abroad under a law like the U.S. Cloud Act. Without a privacy regime strong enough to function as a blocking statute, sovereign infrastructure is really sovereignty theater. The strategy funds the infrastructure, but defers on the law. The online safety promises are similarly short on specifics. The government confirms an online safety bill is coming, this time extended beyond social media to include AI. A law based on a duty to act responsibly, as the last bill did, can be an effective and flexible approach, provided the government avoids one-size-fits-all solutions. But if the bill includes mandated age verification for social media and AI chatbots, that effectively establishes a ban for kids under 16 and risks turning AI for all into ID for all, since everyone would be required to provide identification to use AI. Requiring all Canadians to upload sensitive information to third parties carries deeply concerning privacy risks, and mandated reporting requirements can turn AI companies into surveillance arms of the state. A better approach is transparency, consistent standards, and liability for companies that fail to live up to their policies. Now that brings me to the third event, namely the continued press for lawful access. While the government was unveiling a strategy built on privacy as foundation for trust, it was at the same time pressuring the Public Safety Committee to pass Bill C-22, whose mandatory metadata retention regime may be the single largest privacy risk in Canada in years, and one that comparable countries have already struck down as a violation of the fundamental right to privacy. I noted this week that the disconnect is dizzying. The government can't claim privacy is a fundamental right in the morning and then enact mandatory metadata retention that overrides it in the afternoon. As has been discussed previously on this podcast, the European Court of Justice has struck down the data retention directive in the EU in the Digital Rights Ireland case, and it held that general and indiscriminate retention of every user's telecommunications metadata was a disproportionate interference with the fundamental rights to privacy and data protection. Yet Bill C-22 builds on exactly that blanket model. It would require providers to retain for up to a year the date, time, duration, origin of communications, and location of devices involved. The result is a surveillance map of the movements and communications practices of virtually all Canadians for a year, the very opposite of what recognizing privacy as a fundamental right envisions. And as regular listeners of this podcast will know, retention isn't the only problem. The technical capability powers would let the government require providers to engineer access to communications, and the RCMP has told committee directly that it wants the law to reach encrypted messages. Faced with a comparable demand in the UK, Apple withdrew advanced data protection from that market rather than build in a way. If Bill C-22 becomes law in its current form, it will create pressures to drive privacy protection technologies out of the country. Signal this past week told committee it would leave rather than weaken its encryption. Toronto-based Windscribe said the same on this podcast a week ago. DuckDuckGo and NordVPN have warned they'd pull their VPN services from the Canadian market as well. These are the same tools the government's own cybersecurity guidance urges Canadians to use to protect their personal information. And here's how it connects back to the strategy. Minister Solomon argues a strong privacy law will give Canadians confidence to use AI. But a year of retained metadata on the entire population is precisely the kind of aggregated record AI systems can mine to reconstruct identities and movements from data that was never meant to identify anyone. So whether the government means what it says about privacy won't be settled by the bill that is ultimately tabled by the government, no matter how much fundamental rights language it contains. So that was this past week in digital policy. Three issues, a lot to absorb, and I know that we'll be returning to all three before long, especially with clause by clause on Bill C-22 continuing in the coming week, alongside reactions to both the streaming decision and AI strategy. Until then, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbytes@pobox.com. That's LAWBYTES at pobox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter at lawbytespod or follow Michael Geist at mgeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca or subscribe at iTunes, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo Lebron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose Lebron LeBoy. Credit information for clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening and see you next time.